About 4 months prior to Grafton Street, a contract happened that nearly closed our doors. And for us, the back was against the wall, but we had no option. And I think that's a great place to be because you just have to make it happen.
Hey, welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This is the podcast to show you the secrets and systems world-class founders use to build their business, their body, and their brain. Today, we've got a really special episode. We have a former professional athlete, former pro golfer and pro footballer, now turned founder, Jeff Hopkins, the founder of New Dimensions Active. We hear his story of setback and a never say die attitude that's seen him forge a career in football, then golf, and now as a founder of one of Europe's most fastest growing active leisure brands. Here is my chat with Jeff Hopkins. But first, quick thank you to my partners, Iconic. If you're a regular listener of the pod, which I hope you are, you'll know I've been hosting the podcast from Iconic offices for quite a while now, and things have gone really, really well. So well, in fact, that I'm now a member of Iconic offices, working and recording from one of their spaces. This means I can vouch for the benefits it gives to any business. On that note, Iconic offices have given me a number of exclusive complimentary day office trials for my audience. So try it out for yourself for the day. Bring your team. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description and enter Gary23, so it's Gary23, to claim your complimentary office for a whole day. It's a pretty fantastic offer. Thank you, Iconic offices. Jeff, welcome to the pod.
Gary, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. It's fortuitous. We're recording probably 100 meters from your flagship store.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. It's a bit too close for comfort at this
stage. You're trying to duck, not going in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not in there very often. So
it's an incredible spot. So for anyone not familiar with you or the brand, what is it?
So I am the founder and CEO of New Dimensions Active. We are a fitness and activewear brand.
And if anyone's walked past Grafton Street in the last year, it's coming up in a year now, year anniversary.
Next month is a year, yeah.
You're right at the top or the bottom? I can never figure that out. Top Grafton Street. So you'll see New Dimensions nearly opposite the entrance to Stephen's Green Centre.
Yeah, we face Disney and lifestyle. We're kind of facing them at the moment. So that's
some location.
It's great, yeah. Heavy footfall. But yeah, it was kind of the plan.
I was thinking about it this morning. When I was working out, I was like, you getting your flagship store there is like, I think it was Braveheart when he rides right up to the enemy lines, sticks the flag in the ground,
a little bit of that,
and rides back.
Yeah, there's been a little bit of hardship before that. So I think it was one of those statements.
A big statement because you're right there. You know, you've Lululemon, you've Nike, you've Lifestyle Sports, you've world players, and now you've an Irish brand right there with them. What was behind that?
For us, really, we were 5 years online before we kind of stepped foot into the retail end of it. And for me, it's kind of always all or nothing. And we wanted to make a statement. We are a premium brand. And why would you go anywhere else other than our most premium street in Ireland?
Simple, right? That's ballsy.
Yeah, it sounds very simple there, but there was a lot of curves and a lot of hardship to get there.
But your brilliance is making complex things sound simple because we often overthink things and overtalk things. But it's a big move for a 5-year-old brand to take one of the premium spots in Ireland. Talk to me, though, about the start, because, you know, it's easy to talk about, oh, yeah, now we're on Grafton Street. You know, that's the easy part. Well, it's not the easy part, but that's the, looks great to everyone else, right? Talk to me about the start. Where did it all come from?
So the brand started kind of off the back of, like, I, going back a little bit before that, I still am and was a professional golfer. I did have an injury, which I'm sure we'll get into that in a while. But I started playing around a little bit with designing, and I've always been very passionate about, I've been quite artistic, I think, especially in golf. Golf is quite an artistic sport as well. But it kind of tampered into playing around with an idea of creating something. My mum and my sister had a business themselves already. So it was kind of a simpler transition than one might start on their own with nothing there to support them. So, it was about, I'd say, 6.5 years ago we started it. It took us a year to get it off the ground. Our first product to market was a ladies' legging, which is still our number one seller and will remain. So yeah, that was the.
It's incredible for your first product to be a home run. That's rare.
It was kind of we saw a need in the market for it. And my sister she's an ex-Irish international gymnast. They had a dance store in Drumcondra, and we kind of seen that there was this big gap that was missing there. So I kind of played around a little bit, and we found manufacturing, and we found high quality, and I was in factories all around bloody Europe before I ventured elsewhere.
Went and visited all the places before you started?
We've never made a product from anywhere without visiting it.
Wow.
And something that we're very passionate about. We wouldn't just kind of put it so simple at these days with how technology is, and you don't know where it's coming from and how it's made. And it's something that we've stayed very strong, and it's an ethos within our brand that we'll stick with.
That's a key difference, because I think everyone thinks it's so easy. Oh, drop shipping, just slap a label on it. You know, we talked about influencer brands a while ago. We'll talk about them again shortly. And there's a disconnect, I think, between, because it comes true, right? Buy something, you're like, oh, that doesn't really feel right.
Yeah,
you might be able to put your finger on it, but you're like, it just doesn't feel quite what I thought it would be. Talk to me, bring me further back then about the golf, because you threw that in there as almost an offhand thing. Pro golfer, it's pretty cool. Like, talk to me about that.
Yeah, so look, we'll take it back a little bit before that, because I'm going to have to mention what happened before that to get into golf.
We literally have all morning, so take your time.
So we'll jump into it anyway. But so I played soccer, football, pick your name for it. Growing up, right through schoolboy, I played on Robbie Brady, Jeff Hendricks, famous St. Kevin's team. We were four-time All-Ireland champions, and we were a phenomenal young team. I think, if I'm not mistaken, 9 of our starting 11 for St. Kevin started for Ireland. So
what?
We had a very strong team, yeah. So we got scout, we got trials everywhere. I was away with Liverpool, West Brom, Blackburn. We got to experience that whole lifestyle of being over in the UK playing football.
What was that like as a young lad? Because it's a dream, right?
Yeah, it was a little bit surreal. Like, I think Blackburn, West Brom, those kind of clubs, they're very academy based. So you're in the academies, and you're kind of, there's hundreds of kids coming through, and everybody's fighting for their place. Liverpool was a little bit more of an experience. We got brought out, we trained with the team. We got brought out of pictures of Gerrard, Risa, Crouch, all this. Like, it was a real experience. So for me, coming from a family of United fans.
I was going to say, hold on, you're not a Liverpool fan, are you? No. This will be the shortest pod ever.
No. Coming from a family of United fans, but it was an opportunity you couldn't turn down.
Of course,
you know?
Right?
So that was a bit surreal. Now, the other ones was kind of, I've come through the development systems, I've been on the Irish team, I've played in massive tournaments, so it's kind of the same when you go over to the academies.
Right, okay.
But when you get pulled into that, something so prestigious, like we are on, I've got to get this right now, is it Millfield or something like that is their training grounds now. It's probably real kind of spit in the face to Liverpool fans, but they all stand on their wheelie bins and they look over the wall.
Oh, Melwood.
Melwood, that's it.
Yes.
Sorry. They all stand on their wheelie bins, look over the walls. You got all these heads popping over, watching
wild.
Train, being on the pitch and stuff. So that was a bit mad, all right.
Was that the dream? Be a pro footballer?
It was, yeah, absolutely. Well, look, it was I was born into football. Like, my dad has always played football. My brother was a man. My brother went over to America to play football, so football was in our family since we were scots. And I grew up growing around, getting kicked around by him. He's 4 years older than me, so it progressed me very fast. And at the other side of it, so getting pushing on in the story here is that I was 6'2" when I was 14.
Wow.
And I developed a severe Osgood's lateris, which is it's your knee joints grow faster than the ligaments, and it's severe pain, and I couldn't run. So
when you were young, lad?
When I was young, when I was about 16, from 14 to 16, I suffered with this right through. So
Jesus, that kind of curtailed your football a lot, didn't it?
This stopped it, yeah. It stopped me playing.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
That was the end?
That was the end of it, yeah. Yeah, and this is where, whilst I was injured, I picked up a golf club, and I started turning my focus to actually playing an individual sport, which for me, I actually found a lot more satisfying. You didn't have to rely on anybody. You're what you put into it, you got out of it. You couldn't like header a ball off the line, and your mate would go up and he would smack off his knee and go in, and he would get the clap and the bula bus after it, and everybody would cheer for him when you've just saved the goal. You know, in golf, it's literally you make the mistakes, you make your failures and you deal with them. So for me, I just adapted to this sport like no other. I fell in love with the game. And yeah, from like about 14 to 24, I played golf.
Wow.
I played professionally from 20 to 24.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was, in the space of 15 to 17, I got down to scratch.
15 to 17 down to scratch. Yeah, that's wild.
And then from there, I went over to the UK and I was invited over to a golf academy in the UK. So I actually left home when I was 15. So I went over there playing soccer and I played golf.
Were you chasing the golf dream to substitute in for
the
football?
It was funny. I kind of went over there to play a bit of football, and the golf was there at the kind of the back. So this academy that I went to, I kind of facilitated both. And the injury, just I couldn't play, I couldn't train, I couldn't do anything. So I just started playing golf 10 hours a day, and I got very good, very fast.
Were you channeling all the energy?
I was kind of angry as well. You know, like you're kind of a bit pissed off and you want
to... But your dream gone at 15, as a young lad, it's very hard to hard to process that as an adult. But as a young lad, it's probably like very difficult to get your head wrapped around it.
Yeah, I never really looked back on it and thought of the process of how I dealt with it, to be honest. I kind of have an ability to just keep moving. And I put all the energy that I put into that sport into my next, and the next was golf. And it was much more challenging sport. It's, if anybody asks me, what's the closest thing to business? It's golf. There's a million and one possibilities of what can happen out there. Grass, lie, ball, wind, rain, hail, time it takes you to play, concentrate, everything. It's a minefield. So I love the challenge of it, and that you could never perfect it. And when you thought you had to perfect it, it slaps you in the face. So from when I was 17, then I got selected to play for Ireland, which was my first cap to play for Ireland. I played home at the Nationals. I played boys golf. And then I got the opportunity to go to South Africa to train with the late Wayne Westner. Wayne was a top 20 golfer in the world. And he's a South African. He lived in Ireland. Phenomenal player. Won the Dubai Desert Classic, the World Golf Championship with Ernie Els. His resume goes on, and he took me under his wing, and I went out there, and he taught me everything he knew about the game, became a massive mentor for me.
So you moved to South Africa first.
So I went over there for an 8-week training camp, and at the last week of the 8-week training camp, he turned to me and said, "We have to go to Q school." He says, "You are too good to go home and play amateur golf."
And what age were you?
I was 19. And I went to Q school.
What's Q school for anyone not familiar with it?
It's a qualifying school to get your playing rights to play as a professional. So in theory, you play for money. When you're an amateur, you just play amateur tournaments. There's no real money involved, but you kind of play for ranking. For this now is go in, you can actually start to win money. You can make a living out of it. People can sponsor you. That's the progression of it.
What did you want as a young 11? You were 19, you're going over there. What was your dream then?
Then it was to be a golfer, like everything. Like it was 14 hours a day, every day. Like I did prior to going to South Africa with that same academy that I went to the UK with, I used to spend my winters in Spain. So I spent 6 months in Malaga in the mountains, isolated on a golf course, living on a golf course, sleeping, everything was just golf course. So
what would you do? Tell me about your day, because I find this fascinating. Yeah,
the day was mad. I'll give you a little bit of a nugget of how my brain works. So it was always a competition. There was about 60 guys that trained there. And it was always a case that everybody competed. And it's a great environment to be in because it pushes your limits. It pushes you physically, mentally, everything. And for me, it was that it was always a psychological win if I was up on that driving range first before anybody in the morning. I used to roll out of bed, not even shower, grab the golf clubs, not even have breakfast. run up to the driving range and I'd be hitting balls in the range and lads would be riving up going, Jesus, Jeff's here already. And I'd be hitting balls and then I'd like half an hour later, I was like, right, I'm going to go down for breakfast.
But that was your first win of the day. I love that.
So I used to get that win in early and then like, listen, I was the last person to leave there and there was no cutting corners. You can't, that's the thing about golf is you can't cut corners because you just exposed.
So what was it? Like a training academy or what was it?
It was a training academy. So it was, I was sponsored to go there. So the owner of it paid all my expenses to be there, but people used to pay to be there. So it used to be X fee to be there for a month, accommodation, gym, coaches, wow. The best coaches in Europe got flown in to teach seminars and you had all your amenities were there.
Why was he paying for yours? Just as kind of like a hedge that you might go big?
The academy in the UK. That was the academy that I went to. He owned that academy and he saw my potential when I was there. So he was like, look, I'm setting this up in the UK. I want you to go there. But then what ended up happening with the progression and how kind of good I got in a short period of time, in no time there was 15 or 20 Irish in the academy in Spain. So like the Irish were flooding over to it. So he was making nearly a business thing for him. Okay. So that's the kind of backbone to that end of it. So the academy was it was 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning on the range, and then you'd be leaving there when it got dark at 8 o'clock in the evening.
So what are you training all day? And what are you doing? So
there was a 9-hole par 3 course, so you'd actually go out, we used to do laps of this, like competitions, 10 lads to play, and then you play 9, whoever was lowest score you go again. So you'd burn up about 4 hours playing that. You'd have your coaching, so you'd do an hour on the range with your coach, then you'd go and play on the course, 4 hours to play around the golf. So there's a day in itself, done and dusted.
And you're doing that every day
non-stop.
They're the bits people don't hear about or see. Yeah.
But that's where I think is, you talk about bits that people don't hear and see, it's the same as business.
Yeah.
People don't see the work that goes into it prior. And then when you get successful, they're like, that was the day in and day out of it. So then when I got the chance to go to South Africa, it was the same thing. It was the same camp. It was the same process. It felt easy for me, but now I was under the guidance of Wayne. Unfortunately, Wayne is not with us at the moment, but he was a massive mentor for me. And it was a tragic, some people that are listening, they will know the story. And he was an incredible guy, incredible. And he would probably be, if not the person I've learned the most off out of anybody.
Wow.
And he's been through the ringer. He suffered with a lot of different mental health things, but he taught me some of the life lessons that I'll take to my grave. Massively.
That's an incredible life. Even to get to 19 where you were, there's a lot packed in there. Yeah. Take me then to Q school. What happens there?
Yeah, Q school is where you really battle it out. You 5 rounds of golf, 5 days, and the top 30 gain their playing privileges to play in the tour and the main tour in Africa. And I qualified 6th. As an amateur, so I wasn't even a pro. So I go in there, and if I was a pro, I would have got money for coming 6th, but because I was an amateur.
Oh, right. That was like when Shane Lowry won.
Exactly.
Won
the Irish Open.
Yeah.
So that was the start to the kind of professional career. So that got me my playing rights to play on the Sunshine Tour, which is in South Africa. And I moved camp to Johannesburg, and I was over there on my own. And I kind of tampered between there and Cape Town, depending on where the tour brought us. And then I started getting a lot of invites back to Europe. So one year I was in 38 countries one year.
Wow. What age were you at that stage?
I was about 22.
Wow.
When that kicked in,
That literally is living the dream, right?
No. You may think it.
You're going to burst the bubble of every aspiring golfer and every male hotel, who golfs at the weekends.
Hotel, car, airport, golf course, hotel, car, airport. You're not looking around cities or... Now, if you miss the cut, which I miss my fair share of cuts as well, you get to experience cities and you get to look around, but like you don't, you're out there.
It's the last thing you want. The
last thing you want to be doing is not doing that stuff. So it is a severely tough slog.
I'm fascinated by behind the scenes of sports stars, because we all look at them and we see the 90 minutes on a Saturday at Old Trafford, or we see the lads playing the Sunday in the Masters, and that's all we see. We don't really understand What do they do in a Tuesday afternoon? Yeah. You know, yeah. Grind it out is what they do.
Well, you've got their last week, like Lucas Glover won on the European Tour. And he broke down in his interview saying that now he gets to spend time with his family because he's won.
Mm.
And he's gone like 10-year drought of coming in and out and playing bad golf and stuff like that. And people don't see that. They see like the, oh, he's after winning. God, he played great. But when he has his kids and all his kids are crying and he's crying and everybody's there saying, now I can actually take a little bit of a step back and spend time with my family. And he's at the top, he's pushing on to the 50 mark, you know? So these guys, it's really, really tough out there.
But it is wild when you look at golf. I was watching the Open there recently and you're kind of looking down at the field of whatever it is, 100. There's 99 lads there going away absolutely fuming.
There's, well, like, the best player to ever grace the planet only has ever in his prime won 90, sorry, he's lost 99.8% of the time. So he spent 0.02% of the time winning, and he's the best person to ever, ever play golf.
It must be one of the most unusual sports in the world from that perspective.
Yeah, it's mad.
So I was just sitting there watching on Sunday. It's like, isn't it mad too? Like, you know, one guy goes away, top, that's it.
Yeah.
Career pinnacle, and the rest are just fuming until next Thursday when they do it all over again. And they might go years without a victory.
Years, yeah.
Mentally, it's seem like a very together guy. You seem like you've kind of put it all together. Was that something innate or was that something golf taught you?
That's golf. 1,000,000%. I think the massive thing about it is what it teaches you is how to deal with failure, because you just fail. No matter how good you are, you have to deal with failure constantly. And I think it builds calluses and layers. I feel like a bloody onion at this stage. Like, it will take a while to break me down. But it's all based through golf, 100%.
Talk to me how you approach that. How did you approach? I know we're talking a lot about golf here, so if people are non-golf fans, we're getting to the business shortly. But talk to me through the psychology of it, because as a golfer, as a sports star, you've done both. Talk to me about the psychology of how you would prepare, how you would deal with failure.
To be honest, I think the massive thing about it is acceptance. I got taught a great thing by Wayne, was that, like, here was one, and for anybody listening is don't think of a pink elephant. To not think of a pink elephant, you have to think about a pink elephant. So it's accepting the fact that you can think about a pink elephant, but okay, that's there, but now I'm going to focus on this. So it's like when you're hitting a shot into a tough hole, there's water on the left, your brain's going, don't hit it in the water, don't hit it in the water, don't hit it in the water. But until you accept the fact that the water's there and there's a possibility you could hit it in the water, it's only then that you can say to yourself, well, okay, that could happen, but where I want to put my focus is I want to hit it here. And for me, that has transpired into business now is the business could fail. The business could fail. Like, this could happen. This could happen. Okay. Yeah. But that could happen. But what I am doing day in and day out is trying to put my focus here. So if I can focus on this, that can happen. It's there and I've accepted it, but let's put our focus into this. And I think that's the main thing that's kind of got me to where I am.
I love that, because the pink elephant is a perfect example. Mm. People always talk about, oh, but it mightn't work and it mightn't work. But I think, to either do the one thing where they ignore it and become blissfully ignorant, oh no, it's never going to happen, and they become, you know, they suspend reality. You have to suspend reality a good bit as an entrepreneur, but they suspend it permanently. They've just gone on to a different dimension. You meet them all the time, I'm sure. Yeah. They're just not in tap with the real world. No. I think we talked about this the first time we coffee. You've entrepreneurs and they're just like, they're not tuned into the real world. So for you, your tip is look at it, accept it, move on, move to the real target.
Absolutely, yeah.
And how do you go from pro golfer then to entrepreneur? How does that journey unfold?
To be honest, it happened very fast. And it's something that I kind of adapted to very easily, because the background of golf and the hours that I put into playing a sport, 14, 15 hours a day. When it became to a business and you've got to obviously deal with what you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, it felt very easy because it wasn't physical. Walking a golf course, 30 degrees heat, working out twice a day, all that stuff like that, that it all just became simplistic for me. And I think I gained momentum and ground very fast, because I was able to adapt to elements and circumstances very easily.
So you were used to such a high level of output.
I think so, yeah.
It felt almost seamless to you because...
And even if the output wasn't good, I mean, you were still getting on, you were still putting out more output than anybody else because, and that's what it is. At the end of the day, it's about how much work, and okay, you learn and quality over quantity and okay, but there's a process to get into that.
Yes.
And I think people paralyze themselves with, I need to put out quality, but you're not putting out anything. So
I talk about this in podcasts all the time.
Get yourself to the place.
People get the 80-20 rule arseways. They think it's 20% is the key. It's the 80. Get on, do it. You'll figure out the 20 afterwards. 100%. You've nailed it there. I literally sent someone a voice note this morning. They're asking me about, oh, how many episodes should I have before I get started? It's like, does not matter. Get started. That's the only thing that matters. It's the same for golf, football, business. Just get going.
Yeah.
Stop obsessing about the 20% that you won't have to worry about for years.
Yeah. I think, unfortunately, social media plays a massive part to that.
Yes.
It's becoming it's paralyzing people to make and they're worried about what people's opinions and stuff. And I think it's, unfortunately, some people are made for it. And like you say, some people are made to be entrepreneurs and some people aren't. And unfortunately, there's this big thing around that everybody needs to be an entrepreneur now and everybody needs, and it doesn't need to be that. Some people are made for it and some people aren't, and some people can move on and some people got thicker skin than others. Unfortunately, like you say, with how exposed we all are with these devices in our hands and how businesses can explode so simply by these devices and social media, I think we've got to learn to fail faster and fail more. And people, when they start, they don't do it. They're scared and they're paralyzed by it. So
it's a big part of the reason why this is long form. This is 60 minutes. This is not like give me 6 minutes, Jeff, on your highlights. Because that's bollocks. That's not real world. It's definitely not business. And there is a packaging up. You're exactly right. There's a packaging up of especially business entrepreneur content to go, in 24 months, they did 2 million. You're like, seems unlikely. You know, it's either spoof or they've massaged the figures, you know, it's turnover, not profit. We all know the difference there. Most people don't even think about that. Oh my God, 2 million turnover. Yeah, but they lost 4. They spent 4 acquiring 2 million, you know. It's wild. So when you were golfing, were you ever thinking about being an entrepreneur? I can't imagine were able to afford any mental capacity to anything but golf.
Yeah, no, I think that's why the transition happened so fast was that I needed to put, something that we haven't addressed is that I actually, the reason why I stopped playing golf and made the transition was that, again, I'm prone to injury, put it that way.
I was going to bring up the pink elephant in the room,
I'm prone to injury, but my main nerve in my back has a tail split and it gets trapped under my pelvis. So I was constantly rotating and grinding on it and it just kept flaring up. I was bloody in and out of a physio hut like a toilet when I was in my worst case. Came back to Ireland, went to every specialist under the sun and we couldn't fix it, couldn't figure out. I had 8 procedures. Just the last one, they said, look, we can go in and do keyhole and burn the nerve. And I was like, okay, well, what does that look like? They're like, well, it's probably got a 90% success rate. And I just asked the question, what's the 10% look like? And they couldn't give me an answer. So I had a chat with my specialist.
Major back surgery, right?
It was a major back surgery. It was a keyhole. So they go in, but you're messing around with the main nerve in your back. And they're going in, it's a tail split off it. So it was like, obviously friction and grinding has caused a hair. It's nearly like a hair of a nerve. And it's getting stuck under the pelvis. And
as a golfer, your rotation is the whole thing,
even
right?
If you look at me now, I'm sitting in a little bit of an awkward position. I can't sit properly still. I can train fine, but like sitting is the most uncomfortable position for me. So I don't know what aggravated it, what started it, but it is golf because when I go back to play, it flares up.
That's the ultimate cruelty.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, that was it. Look, the golf was a lot harder of a pill to swallow than the football. I was very young with the football. But the golf, I could see a lot of potential and I had a lot of people that had a lot of faith in me and a lot of people had invested in me. Like I had investors and I had sponsors and I had a lot of people who were very good to me and looked after me. So it was a tough kind of a few months, I would say, that I had to deal with it, that in my own head myself. And you have your ups and downs, but I just felt like I needed to put it into something and put it into something fast.
How do you come to that decision? Was that I have no decision here? Or was that something where you're like, I can battle on, but never be right? Like, how
did
you deal with that?
I battled on. I battled on for 2 years. And it got to the stage where I couldn't drag my right leg because the nerve was catching as I walked.
Jesus Christ.
They've shocked my whole nervous system with 4 epidurals. So to put into context, when you have a baby, you have 1. So they did me, they got me right down the spine to try and suck the nerve back up. So to really, really take the inflammation away from it. Didn't work. I've done cortisone shots. I've done PRP, which is they extract your blood, they mix it with plasma and they eject it back into the area. It has that probably had the best result out of anything, but it was only like a 2-week lasting and then we were back to square one.
Really? Two weeks?
2 weeks.
So you were going through every single thing to try find the solution.
Absolutely, yeah. And unfortunately, I don't think the solution was in Ireland. I think it might have been elsewhere, but at that time, my sponsors and the guys who were involved with me, they were all here and my specialist was here. And at this time, a specialist is one of the best in Ireland. And his last thing in the world is surgery. Like, he'll do everything under the sun to not put you under the knife. And we sat down, we talked about it and we got to the conclusion is, look, this might be just something that you have to live with and we can build a program around you.
What age were you at this stage?
This was between 22 and 24. And then it carried on then 25, 26. I was still I had a medical then. So when you get a medical, you keep your status on the tour, but you go and you try and fix the problem that you have. So then if you do fix it or if it's surgery or what it may be, you come back and you can play again.
So you have to do medical to play.
So I had medical is when you get like the specialist will sign off to say that he has a reason he can't play.
Right, right, right.
So I had that exemption and I had it for 1 year.
You were still in South Africa?
I was back home now at this stage because there was nothing over there for me that could fix my problem.
Gotcha.
That was the kind of start of the journey of trying to figure it out, but we never got there. Still never got there. And the icing on the cake was...
And you're a young dude. Like anyone, if people are listening on Spotify or Apple, you're a very young dude. Like you're athletic looking, you're fit, you're an athlete. Yeah. So to see a debilitating injury, it's quite jarring. Like if he looked you in the street, you'd be like, man, fit looking guy.
I think this is where people couldn't get their head around what was actually going on, and especially my sponsors. Because they were looking at me, and when you look at me stature wise, you'd go, sure, how could he be injured? Like, I was one of the longest hitters on the tour. I had everything I had the game for it, but I couldn't walk. That was the problem. Kind of, but you couldn't physically see it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we spent a lot of time sitting, traveling. I'd get on a plane, I'd be in agony. I'd go get into a car, drive to the hotel, be in agony, So it was just a constant battle with that end of it. So. And then the icing on the cake was that I got a phone call from, I won't say what organization, but they wanted to use me as a guinea pig because they had never come across an issue like mine. And they wanted to take me in and take blood from me every whatever month or so. And obviously at this stage, I was frustrated. I was like, no, thank you. Either fix me or...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not donating don't my body to science just yet. I'm not going out to pasture just a minute, but thanks for that.
That was the backbone. That's where we led into the business.
No pun intended. Where? I know, we laugh. You didn't laugh.
The arse is the one that gets me.
If you didn't laugh, you'd cry, right? Yeah, so literally. How did you, I know we're kind of laboring this point, but I think it's important for people to understand your journey and understand what it's like as a pro athlete, because I think the rest of us never get to see this side of things, never get to understand how hard it can be. How did you come to that decision going, that's it, I have to now move on? And then how did you move on?
Yeah, I think I came to the conclusion when I sat down and had that conversation with my specialist and said, look, this is something that you're going to have to live with. And it's something that could be... he said over the years, there's circumstances where people develop these things and they go when you're 35, they leave when you're 40 and they can disappear and come and go at different times. So he said, you're just going to have to monitor it and something that you might have to just live with at the moment. It's that or surgery. And he was like, I'm not advising your surgery because a sport is a sport. But if you lose the feeling in your right leg, he said we're into a different kettle of fish here, and it's something that we probably don't want to be discussing. So he kind of talked me around, not around it. There was no other option. It was that or surgery. So I accepted it then. And kind of how I got over it was I deep dived into the business and just put my soul focus into something else. I think if I went into limbo and kind of maybe went and did a course or a college course, and to give a little bit of a backbone to this, is I left school when I was 15 to pursue sport. So I didn't really have anything to fall back on.
Right.
Like, it was, sport was my life. And then two injuries that fell back to back in two separate sports got me, left me in a kind of a no man's land. And but I knew that I'd always be okay. I always knew that I'd be able to figure something out. I had jobs and I was young. I was fucking in the chip shop when I was 15, serving fish and chips and stuff like that to make a buck. So I always knew I wasn't scared of working and I'd always find my feet, but I didn't know what had me down this road.
You left the tour and then you go to business. Did you just jump straight into the business, or what was the transition? Because I'm trying to understand how you actually got involved. Did you just kind of look around and go, I don't want to do a course, I don't want to get a job, I'm going to go into the family business?
I stepped back, and so my, like I said, my sister and my mom had a shop in Drumcondra. It was like a dancewear store. And I stepped in there. They were struggling a little bit. I don't know to what extent and reason why, but I stepped in. Didn't take a salary for nearly a year, helped them build up their business. We were really getting the ball rolling with them, and we were getting them into different industries and different areas. And we were, at that time, what I was doing was I was designing custom-made dancewear clothes for teams and sports and football clubs. And
it's a hard left from being a golfer.
I know you're
saying the creativity, but that's how did you even come up with that idea?
It was something that was out there, but we had the ability to put a focus towards it because we had dealt with a lot of these schools, and my mom and my sister would have a list of these people that would come in that owns dance companies, and they'd come in and get their shoes, tights, all that malark. And we had a kind of an in, so there was a need in the market for it. So we jumped into it and we started custom manufacturing, like design head to toe. It's actually called sublimation. It's like there's no external printing. It's all dyed into the material. So we started doing that. And I did that. We built it up to a certain level, and the company was doing really well. And then it wasn't where I wanted to be. I was giving them a dig out, and then I kind of got my teeth into it. And then we seen this need for the, like I said to you earlier, was this need for a legging. And we went down the road of finding it and perfecting it. And I think the advantage that we have is that we're dealing, like myself and my sister, who's heavily involved in the company. She was the test dummy, really. It was like, here you go, try them on, tell me what you think, come back to me tomorrow, go for a run, go do your cartwheel, a somersault. If they can withstand what she does, we knew we had something good. And that's kind of where it really started and stemmed from.
It's quite an unusual departure from a golfer to designer, especially if you went and started a golfwear business. I'd be like, oh yeah, it's kind of obvious, right?
Yeah.
But I'm trying to understand the mental process of you going.
Yeah, I mean,
because you didn't seem to stop. You just moved, which I admire. Like, momentum breeds results. I'm a big believer in that. So you got involved in the dancer business, hive that off, and then your sister and you kind of like were thrashing out ideas, or how did it start?
Yeah, we kind of like through that dynamic of designing clothes for dance schools and stuff like this. You have proper athletes in there. You've got like people that are in college in America, and in, you got Irish dancers who are phenomenal athletes, and they couldn't find anything in the market that suited fit. So we kind of understood that there was something there that was missing.
Okay.
So we had an in. It wasn't like we were just bringing a singular product to market and then being like, right, we're starting from scratch. We had a customer base as such, not a huge one. It took a lot of time to build. But for me, I've always been artistic. So I think golf is, and Wayne, as I spoke earlier, he used to say to me, it's like golf is like painting on a canvas, is that you've got to visualize the shots before you hit them. And if you can't see it, you'll never hit it. So it's similar to with the creative side of of the artistry. And I painted when I was a kid, and I was always drawing, and I was always kind of in that space. But you wouldn't look at me and think that that's kind of like the...
No, I definitely wouldn't. don't imagine you sitting with a with kind of glass in the end of your nose with a sketch pad and Stephen's green. I don't really see it.
Yeah, no, you won't find me there. Don't worry. but yeah, that's kind of the transition into.
So I'm always curious about that 0 to 1 bit. I think that's the bit that trips up so many people, and I'm always kind of curious to tease that out, because I think it's always interesting for people to hear that bit, because that's the bit that people don't do. They don't do the 0 to 1. And just on what you said there, I think you do have to see it to be it. I think there in Ireland we need a bit more of that. That's why a big reason why I do this podcast is to project entrepreneurs out and go, look, this is Jeff. Jeff's just like you. You can be like Jeff. Like, it's not, I think we often get kind of you alluded to it earlier with social media. You know, there's a lot of fake stuff on there, or stuff you can't relate to, like stuff in the US or stuff. And you're like, that's not me. You know, I can't be that person. So I think you have to see it to believe it. So you got your sketchpad out, you designed the ultimate legging. Mm-hmm. And then what was the next step? Because you said you went and visited the factories. Yeah. So even break that down for me. How do you even understand as a golfer to go, right, I'm going to be an entrepreneur now, I'm going to design this, but I must go visit factories. How do you figure that out?
It was a little bit different when we started as well. Like now there's a lot more access to, I would say, there's systems out there that nearly do this for you now. Mm. When we started, there wasn't so much of that process. So we had to do our groundwork, and we wanted to pick the places that we wanted to manufacture in. We tested out all the technical materials. So like, obviously we're heavy in the fitness and activewear space. So we are a very technical, we deal with a lot of technical fabrics. The likes of Portugal, even if you were to go to Cambodia, stuff like that, they are very poor at technical fabrics. So we had to find the right places that we could go, and it took a while. Like, it took 14 months to bring our first product to market from first factory visit to sampling. We got a batch on our floor that we just, it was a big investment at the time. It was like €3,000 at the time, but felt like a huge investment. But they didn't go on sale. We just literally put them in the back. They're probably still somewhere knocking around.
What happened?
They just arrived wrong. The sampling that we received and what I'd drawn and tested, it didn't arrive the same. They'd got it wrong. And I think this is the hardship. A lot of people would give up then because it was one product. Huge outlay, huge cost, and we had to start from scratch again.
So what did you think there when that happened?
For me, it just sparked a fire that I had to get it right.
Kind of guessed that was going to be it. Right?
That I think that really triggered it, because that's where we really gained momentum then was when I was like, that was it. I was like, right, this is when my back's against the wall. I think it's when I tend to stand the tallest. And yeah, that's for me was a defining point. I think in the whole projection of the business was that very start, because it went wrong and it could have been like, pack it in, but we didn't, thank God.
So you got the first product, eventually you got there and it was perfect. How do you find customers? Because distribution is the key thing that trips up a lot of companies, especially online space, because you know, at the time you don't have a store, you can't just rely on people walking down the street. Yeah. Where did you find your customers?
So customer base, we built the website, number one. And then we kind of tapped into the influencer model a little bit at the start. We didn't go heavy after it. A lot of companies went crazy on it, but we wanted to kind of walk before we could run. My sister had a little bit of a platform when we started out. So she obviously was a test dummy for it as well. And she trained in it and loved it. And that gained people's trust to buy the product. And then the minute the product got in people's hands, it was like wildfire. Our customer base was word of mouth. We literally stopped doing influencing. We couldn't keep up with our orders because it was like Joanne was telling Gemma and Gemma was telling Katie and Katie was going boom. And next of all, the person that bought one, they were back to buy three. And next of all, they were asking for more colors because they wanted to work and they wanted colors for work. And it just went like that very fast. It was that word of mouth was our big one.
It's funny, like, I ask everybody because it's really interesting. It's the key question for a lot of companies, and nearly it's always word of mouth. It's not the thing that you're like, oh, we did this, that, and the other. Usually it's all word of mouth.
Yeah.
Well, build a great product, number one. That's the core.
Well, there you go.
And then layer on, do great things.
I think that's why what you mentioned earlier about a lot of the influence and stuff and companies that are coming up from so-called people of influence, a lot of it isn't, it's like a fast revenue, people jumping at things that they have a platform and their passion isn't in the product. So I think that's when you put a bad product to market.
Yeah.
And if you put a bad product to market, I tell you, bad word of mouth is worse. It spreads a lot faster than good word of mouth.
People can see a money grab. Yeah. People can see going, oh, I followed you for years, I respected you, and now you just rinsed me for 100 quid for some subpar. Because you love supporting people. People love supporting people.
And Irish are the best at it, I think.
Yeah.
I think if Irish people find a brand or something that they love, they will scream and shout from the rooftop about it. And I think that's great. And unfortunately, there is more kind of bad taste left in people's mouths at the moment because there's been more fitness and activewear brands started and closed in our period of the last 4 years than, like, I mean, I don't have enough fingers and toes to count.
It seems super crowded.
Like, it got really crowded there at one stage, and it was ridiculous how crowded it was because people were coming out with the same products, which was a different logo emblem on them. And you knew where they were getting it, how they were doing it. And it just felt silly, nearly. So thank God we were before that era and we got our customer base in, and we have a story behind of what we do and why we do it. We are athletes. We test our product. We're so passionate. I'm so passionate. Nothing will go on the market if it is not thoroughly tested. And we know it can withstand what I do and what my sister does in the gym because the two of us train probably harder than most people. So
your Instagram is pretty motivating. I won't lie. I do. But if I'm ever wavering on the gym, I just go, yeah, Jeff's had it.
But I don't like to show all the ups. I try to tend to tap in. And we've got a good community of guys who I train with, and we've started a thing now as well. Well, I started a thing on Saturdays, is training with a group of lads on the beach. Mm-hmm. Getting lads out there, getting lads training, it's good for headspace. It's good to get guys together to chat, to talk.
Yeah.
I think COVID just separated everybody massively. And I think it's great for, like, all these guys might have businesses. Some of them own gyms. Some of them own actual companies that sell a product. So it's great to bring lads together. We go for a swim. You get a bit cold and then you go for a bit of food and stuff. It doesn't happen enough, to be honest. So it's great now.
It's powerful.
To be able to tap into that.
Especially for lads, kind of lads as you get into your 30s and 40s, because when you're younger, you're surrounded by your mates, right? You grow up with your mates and your college with your mates and you're all living in the same city. It's all great crack. But then life happens and you start to move away and you fragment and you get busy.
Yeah.
You're busy running businesses and you're busy. I ask every single person, I'll ask you at the end, what have you sacrificed for your success? And it's quite sad, the answer. Because I thought about this last night. I was lying in bed and I was thinking about it. I was like, it's quite sad. They all say, time. Time with my friends, time with my family. Shit, that's all we have.
Yeah.
Like, I think for you, people, I think, project this thing, oh, 24/7, man, all in. I'm like, it's one way of doing it.
Yeah.
It's not for me. I don't think it's for you because I have the exact same routine as you every Saturday morning, 7 a.m. in the sauna, 30 minutes into the sea, coffee. It's about four or five of us.
Yeah.
And we've grown to become mates. It was just one or two of us at the start. Then just, people, you attract people in, you attract people, keep coming, like real honest conversations.
Yeah.
Like some of the stuff gets so deep. It's 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning and it goes deep. You're kind of sitting there going,
here after it at 9.
God, I think I'll have another coffee. But it's powerful because there's lads, like lads' mental health, like in my own friend group, we've been badly affected by it. And like it's a serious spiral if people go down it, because often there isn't that group where you can just talk and just on a Saturday or just once, you have to be able to just talk.
Yeah. And I think it's huge. I think the training element of it is so powerful because for me, talk about mental health is like you're running businesses, your people rely on you, you've got staff and you can get it down this rabbit hole of making excuses that you're working all the time and you're tired and you're this and you're that and you're not making any time for yourself. And I think you can only, like, something I live by is that if I'm not in the pinnacle of my health and I'm not running at between 90 and 100%, well, how can I expect to project that to my staff to do the same and the people that are around me? And I think it's so important now, and especially for male, like I'm saying to you, is like, I don't know if I suffered a mental health or maybe it was just a lull or if there's up or downs, but how can you be in a great headspace if you've never been in a bad one?
Mm.
you have to understand what bad is to be in a good place.
I couldn't agree more. Sun all the time brings a desert.
Exactly.
Like,
so I think believe it's,
you don't want it to be. You don't want it to be there.
I don't think lads talk about it at all.
But I agree with you 100%. The last 2 years for me have been horrific. But now as we're coming out of it, I'm like, that was bloody awful. I'd never wish to go back. But now I'm 100 times stronger.
But you're actively making decisions yourself to be better.
Exactly.
And I think that's the massive thing is it's not going to happen if you don't action it.
No, it
doesn't. But I think if you're around people that do action it, and I think this is where we're getting at is the Saturdays are good, is because it keeps people away from socializing on the Friday because they know they have to get up on that Saturday and go and do or whatever. For me was I go down to the beach and some of the lads, I just hockey them. We just get into a mad sending session and everybody afterwards, they're all knackered, but you feel so much better.
Yeah.
And then you go for a bit of grub and you have your chats and lads get into deep stuff. Some people have kids, some people have other issues and so on, but you can chat about it. Mm. You go out, do whatever you want to do on your weekends, but then it comes Monday, you face that problems again. You haven't spoken to anybody or whatever. Yeah, so
you've suspended it through drink or food or whatever it is over the weekend. You've had that 24-hour respite, whereas instead of actually tackling it and getting a 365 respite, you've just temporarily plastered over the thing. I think it's changing, though. Even this conversation we're having here, I don't think this had happened 5-6 years ago. I think people are more open about it now and more aware. For me, I'm far more aware. I'm far more aware of what impacts my mood. I'm far more aware of, you know, okay, it's consistency of effort over a month. If I consistently work out, if I consistently put that time in, eat well, you're going to feel way, way better. And it's compounding. 100%. But like you said, it can't be all happy roses all the time. That's why I appreciate your honesty at the start. That's why I went into it, because it's important to talk about these things. I think too often we're like, oh, and you've a great business now. Great stuff. Good lad. It's not real. It's not real life. I think you have to understand the struggles and then the hardship that it can be for people because it's so much sweeter for you now to have got here.
Like to give it to an example of where we are at now, but the road to getting to where we are now, you talk about Grafton Street and you say, yeah, look, it's amazing that we have that premises. About 4 months prior to Grafton Street, a contract happened that nearly closed our doors. Four months prior to taking Grafton Street.
So from the highest to the lowest.
Something was pulled from underneath us and it was a little bit of a dirty trick, but we had to really sit back and look at it and how do we adjust. And one thing that we don't have investors. We own the company 100% ourselves. And we were in a position that we had to really navigate and understand how are we going to turn this around? Because we had an opportunity to shift a lot of product. It's on the water. It's coming to us. And now we don't have a place to sell it. And that's kind of where we really had to dig our claws in and get into the nitty gritty of it. But it made us who we are now at the other side of it. Now we're nearly 18 months down the line. But these were things that, like, I had gone down the road to take in an investor because I thought that maybe, or investors, that it was something that we needed, and I couldn't make these big jumps for Grafton Street on my own. We did a big collaboration with Vogue Williams, and these are things that we couldn't tackle if we didn't have it. And then when these things fall through and people kind of maybe let you down in certain ways or circumstances happen, I think you only realize that what you can do. And for us, the back was against the wall, but we had no option. And I think that's a great place to be because you just have to make it happen. And we've done two of the things that I thought that I was taking in investment to do. We've done them ourselves. So it's a bit of a pat in the back moment, but for now, like it's what does the future hold for us, you know?
It's all, like, you don't want to be there all the time, but sometimes you get into those situations and you think you're at a 10. You think you've turned the dial up to 10 effort. You're like, oh, it's up to 10. And then it happens. And you have to spin it to 50. And you're like, Jesus, I didn't even know that I went past 10.
I know.
But it goes back to your point about, you know, it can't be good all the time. You know, those stressful situations, you show, damn, there's much more in the tank here. And you have to break through those barriers. And I think, you know, there's always the next room. There's always the next room you can go into. You think, oh, this is it. We're in the main room now. And then it's like, oh, this is a side room over here where these other lads are in, and you just want to go in there and see what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But how do you, your mental game seems to be strong. You just seem to keep moving forward. What was the solution to move all that stock?
The solution was to find a premises that had the footfall that that could move it for us.
Right.
And now we were 4 months behind and a fit out in the bin, pretty much.
Was this your first retail store?
So our first retail store where we were going to a 2-story unit or create a full experience, and it was pulled from underneath us. So we had to really adapt fast. And look, thankfully we did. It's funny because I had viewed 47 Grafton Street prior to COVID, and I was told to not take it because something was coming. And I have bought that man a many of beers because the day before I pulled out, I said that we're stepping away, and then everything was locked down the next day. And it was a unit we were going in for a pop-up. We weren't taking it like a period of time we've taken it for now. But yeah, it's funny how it transpired that the unit we was looking at, we ended up in anyway down the line.
How do you, like, you're largely self-taught. So where do you get this information from? Is it mentors? Is it self-learning? What is it?
I think a huge amount of it is self-learning for me. But a lot of it is just not being scared to fail. For me, I mean, other people might be different. I don't have a huge amount of mentors. One of my main mentors, like I said to you, he's passed away, but he taught me a lot in the golf space, which it's incredible how much it transpires into business. Every element of the hardship that I've faced, I faced it in golf already, and it's just the same process how to deal with it. So I mean, I could definitely do with more mentors. I'm only 31, so I hope to have many mentors and have mentors till I'm 80. I mentor some guys coming up through the ranks already myself. I love to help, and it's something that I will continue to do. But you always need people. You always need people to bounce off. And I think Ireland is quite closed off with that a little bit. I don't think there's enough of it. I don't think there's enough of guys that will reach out. And maybe it's because we're all busy and we all have our own shit to run.
It's so important though. I understand what you mean. And I've tried to crack this nut for the last kind of 3 years because I meet so many great people. I've been trying to pull them all together for ages and I just haven't been able to crack that nut. Yeah. Like I'm getting fragmented. So I'm behind the machine pumping it now. So I'm introducing you to someone else, to someone else, to someone else. All quite fragmented. Like there definitely is a need for that in Ireland. Like there is, because there's so many great entrepreneurs, but we're all quite siloed. We're all trying to figure out the wheel at the same time. Yeah. You know, there's
everybody's at different levels of why they'd be in that, sitting at that table. Like there'd be some guys that might be in the position that they've exited and they want to invest. There could be other guys that want to learn. Then there's a lot of guys kind of in the middle of the pack there, yeah, which probably were around where I'm sitting, and you're in the fire line, you're fighting, and it's trying to find the time to give your time to the right places. But yeah, it's you're right. It is hard to get everybody down.
Bring me up to speed to where New Dimensions are now, because you started with lagging, but like you walk past your graphics store, you have an extensive range. Bring me up to speed on where you are.
Yeah, so I mean, right now we have about 17 styles of leggings. Ranging from literally every possible fabric that you could have to length and shape. We have full menswear collection of, we've got a running collection, golf collection.
Jeff's sporting some lovely, is that the golf collection right now?
These are a bit of the golf and casual wear.
Yeah, sporting it well.
But yeah, we've really gone after our gung-ho at the moment is that I think a lot of companies are listening to a lot of noise and wanting to please everybody. We've really honed in on this year is our campaign was maxed out and it was all about athletes and people maxing out in their sport.
Like that.
So yeah, we have a lot of ambassadors who are phenomenal athletes, like professional boxers to tennis players to golfers to runners, the whole lot. And it's to showcase them doing what they do on the day-to-day basis and maxing out in our clothing because, well, you can. And it's something that we, like even your average Joe, like who do you watch on? I don't mean to call you average Joe, Gary.
I was going to say, hold on.
When I'm looking at these guys training, like I'm looking at them going, like these guys are competing in the biggest podiums in the world. And I'm going, God, what are they wearing? What are they doing? Like what do I need to obviously have myself?
Yeah. Oh, look, I all the time, like I that's why I asked you so much about your career, because I'm fascinated by sport and high level performance.
Yeah.
What are they doing? What are they eating? And it's not like, oh, I'll just eat that and I'll be a high level performer. It's not that at all. But it's always about just trying to improve yourself slightly. I have, you have that growth mindset. I have the same. What are they doing? Like, why, yeah, I just, I mean, think you always got to look to see it to believe it. You see it to be it. I'm a big believer in that. So I think that's a great idea to. And it's also to, I think there's a disconnect between athletes and the general public. You get a snapshot of performing on Saturday. I think there's a huge value, and I love all the behind the scenes stuff the football clubs are doing now.
Yeah,
they've all seen the growth of the Amazon documentaries about every football team. Yeah. So now they all have their behind the scenes documentaries. Love that.
Showcasing a little.
Love it. Like, it's, make them human.
But, and there's one thing that I like when I sit in and have meetings with any of our ambassadors, and when we bring them in and we sit at the table, I always talk to them and I talk about, like, I'm not coming as a person here that's just giving you clothes or giving you, or if there's an agreement, whatever. We're here as a mentorship, and the athletes that come in, I'm coming from such a background to it, in two sports and hardships and what works for me. And the conversations that I have, we have an athlete called Gary Cully, and he's a phenomenal boxer. And we would sit there and talk all day about the mentality that he has in boxing to the mentality that I have in golf is the exact same.
Yeah.
You're on your own when you're in that ring and you're on that golf course. It's the shit that goes on in your head. Mm. And unfortunately, with golf is that you're out there for like 5 hours. You might last 2 minutes in a ring, so you don't have that long to think about it, you know? So we're just always bouncing around. And it's really good to get this kind of understanding from different sports and athletes and what they want and need and what they love. Mm. And for us, is that's what we've now filtered into our everything that we bring to market. It's more for, if it's good enough for the high level athletes,
yes,
it's good enough for the people. And this is where our reviews are so high and people are raving about our clothing, is because of that fact. We're tailoring it on the basis of that it's performance wear for athletes.
Mm. It's something very simple. I wear a Whoop.
Yeah.
And when you log in, it's athlete.
Yeah.
It's the smallest little marketing trick, but I noticed it and I was like, look at that.
It's, nice, yeah.
It's just little touches. So I love that. I love that kind of insight. Yeah. Is there anything just on the mental side of things? You're talking about the been on the golf course for 5 hours. Mm. How would you keep yourself level and focused for 5 hours? Because for me, I find my focus tends to hop around, right? It's modern life.
Yeah.
I think of it as Chrome tabs open in my head. I'm trying to close all those tabs in my head just so I can focus down. It's something I've actively been working on. How would you do that on the golf course and now in business?
So you can't physically focus for 5 hours. So you have this threshold.
Even that's good to admit, I think.
Yeah, you've got this threshold of like 90 seconds before your shot and kind of 60 seconds after your shot. And everything in between is usually down to having a good caddy and distracting you.
Okay.
So you can't be in high performance mode for 5 hours. So one thing was that what I used to do when I was on the course was we used the bird spot. So everywhere we went, we used to try and find different birds.
Most surprising answer of the season goes to Jeff.
Yeah. Because you'd be in these mad countries and you'd see eagles flying and you'd see little birds and everything. But I got this from my my coach, Wayne. And Wayne could spot, he was actually a game ranger, like in a safari.
That's
for years.
Wild.
So he knew every bird, he knew the pattern and you'd under their wings. And when you'd be playing, he caddied for me at tour school and we'd be there chatting about different things. And he'd be going, that's a this and that's a that. And look at those tracks here. And next of all, you'd be like, oh, you're going to hit my shot. Okay, right, there's your target. Let's go.
Okay, so in and out of periods of focus. Yeah, that's your tip.
That's it. And being able to do that. And the only way you're able to do that is by practicing it. Like, if you're a desk worker or if you are in a certain thing that you work all day in a certain place, like you'll hear the high level people 40 minutes, 20 minutes do something else, or they get up, they move around 40 minutes in. And when you do that all day and you do that for about a month, you can come in and out of focus like that.
It's exactly what I've been doing. You know? I've been doing that Pomodoro, but I've been stretching out to 45 and 15, 45, 15. And then if it's a big, big chunk of work needs to get done, 90 minutes, sit there, crank it out, and then stop.
Yeah.
And then go.
Yeah.
Because it's law of diminishing returns, right?
You
peak, and then gone. The 45 and 15, it's as close to that limitless drug, I think, as we have. And it's such a simple thing. Deep focus, no focus, deep focus. So it's interesting to hear that from a sports
person. It's funny because I did it in sport, but you know what? I probably am terrible at doing it now. I just go into the battlefield and like it is a battlefield. You're just fighting fires all day. So, I mean, it's hard to switch off for 15 minutes and tell someone you'll come back to them when I should probably do it. And there are things that I probably need to get better at, you know.
Practice, right? Reps.
I get in at the end of the day and then like you say, is I go to the gym or whatnot, like you can be physically and mentally drained because you're just battling all day. But that's what we sign up for, isn't it?
Balance. What's coming up for New Dimensions in the next kind of 6 to 12 months? What are we looking out for?
Yeah, like, I mean, for us is we're very much at the phase of an international, some format of an expansion. That does come down to a financial element as well, because when you're going to step into different markets, it becomes a different beast. Our footfall in Grafton Street is massively international. And what we hear on a day-to-day basis, like my brother, he's moving to America shortly, and that's probably going to be our move. But he is sick and tired of hearing people telling him that we need to bring the brand to America. So, I'd say in the next 12 months, we'll be definitely looking at some format of an expansion, and what that looks like. It depends what's on the table, you know.
I like the NDA, actually. I really like that logo. It's good. I'm going to do a quick fire round.
Yeah.
What book would you recommend every entrepreneur must read?
For me, a book that has had the most impact is A Monk Who Sold His Ferrari.
I think Robin Sharma?
Yeah.
5 AM Club, very good. Yeah, read it once, thought it was absolute horseshit. Read it a second time, thought it was game-changing. The right book at the right time. I talk about this all the time.
Yeah. For me, it was about kind of slowing down a little bit and understanding things a little bit better, and not everything needs to be a million miles an hour. And the burnout rates and stuff like that, they're all little nuggets that I took out of the book, but it's a super book.
The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. I think that's the first time recommendation. What's something you didn't pay enough attention to early on that you had to learn the hard way?
Do you know what? Is blocking out other people's opinions to what they think should be the way to do things. It's a little bit of a roundabout answer, but I think I listen to a lot of noise and voices of telling me, and I know the business better than anybody. I'm there from before day one to now, and then you listen to interference from other people of what they think is the right thing to do. And unfortunately, it's out of the goodness of their heart.
Yes, but they mean well, but they're giving it well, on their experience.
Yeah, exactly. And you hear that a couple of times, the same thing, and then you start going down that road, and then you come to the realization is you should listen to your gut. And then I think that's, for me, is one thing.
That's really good. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
A back.
Walking normally in a straight line.
Look, I mean, there's a lot of roundabout answers here. For me, it's my decision. I've probably sacrificed friends, time, but I think you find new friends at the right time. You find the right people that are supposed to be around you. I would like to spend more time with my family, and it's something that I'm going to make a very big effort to do now in the next coming years. Your parents aren't always there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's something that I'm going to make a valid effort for. And it's tough. My mum's a workhorse. She's 5 days a week working in the company at the moment, Monday to Friday. So when you're working with them day in and day out, it's hard to spend that quality time. But it's something that I'm going to make a valid effort for.
I like that. But you're still spending time with her, which is magic as well. What would you do today if I gave you 10 million euro?
I mean, for me, it would just go straight towards the company. If you're talking about an investment side of things of a return, I can't see anything else that would give me a bigger return than investing it into my own company right now. Because we're at that, like, that's probably where we're at, is that's what's needed. And that would be it for me.
Perfect. What's one thing in your daily routine you wish had started sooner?
Reading. Yeah, I've always been a terrible reader, and I am dyslexic, so reading was always tough. I was reading words that were never even on the page.
Right.
But the more I read, the better I got. And I think for me, it's something that I do daily now, and it's something that I read last thing. I read something, and I always read self-improvement books, but the last thing I think about has to be something positive before I sleep. So for me, that's a massive factor.
I really like that. Yeah, you're embedding that in your subconscious then for the night.
Subconscious for 8 hours, you're just lying there. I mean,
it's powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that. Reading is the closest thing. I can't meditate. I can't, not that I can't. I don't meditate because I just haven't been able to find it. But reading for me, it's just that deep focus.
Absolutely.
Drop into the other world and you're just like, it's the closest thing we have to time travel. Like you get that book and you're like, wow, you're somewhere else. You're at a different time. You're in a different head. You're in a different body. It's amazing. Reading is the one for me. I'm going to give you 1 million euro to invest. Can't be in your own company. Who are you picking?
Ooh, I mean, you'd have to look at, I know it might be a little bit of a, I don't know if it's a cliche answer. I haven't heard other people's answers, but like, I think Elon's forward thinking and the way he navigates markets and has understandings of things before they actually happen. I think I'd probably put my faith in him to give me a nice return on that.
It's weirdly a controversial answer now because he's got cancelled, but I would, if I had to, gun to my head, I'm like 1 million into Tesla or into X or into pretty much anything because he's you do it once, okay, you do it again and again simultaneously, next level. If you'd start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
I can't say what it is because there might be something in process. It's so far off the beaten track that you wouldn't even believe. And it's to do with bathrooms. I'll leave it there.
Okay. It's a good clip either way. What do you believe that people, other people find weird or strongly disagree with?
Do I believe? Burnout and overworking and all this. I think it's it's a lot of shite. How do you know how you can burn out if you've never pushed the barriers of what burnout really is? I perform the best when I am on my knees, when there's no option. So when you're going months like that and you don't know what comes now, at some point in time you might burn out, but I mean, there's such a wide variety. People have got very soft and unfortunately it's becoming a thing. You need to take a break. You need to rest. I train twice a day. I mean, I don't need to rest. People tell you need to rest because they're not training twice a day. But unfortunately, yeah, that's for me.
I like that. You're turning the dial up to 50 all the time.
Yeah.
I like it. Nothing wrong with that. I think each their own. Self-awareness is the biggest superpower you can have. In your personal life, what's one thing you spend money on that dramatically increases your happiness?
Like what makes me happy is traveling, like seeing new things, places. I'd spend money on experiences. I'm not a pretentious person whatsoever. Believe it or not, I'm sitting here. I don't even have a car. There's a little nugget for you as well. Like I don't spend money on things that I feel like I don't need, but traveling, experiences.
Where's your favorite place to visit recently?
I went skiing in Val d'Isère and it was incredible. Now, it's a very expensive place to go skiing, but some of my mates are off-piste crazy men and they bring a bit of excitement to it. So I went for a week there and that was like, it's just an incredible place. It really is. So for me, it's experiences.
What's your one piece of final advice to every entrepreneur or aspiring entrepreneur listening?
The best advice I can give to anybody is to fail fast, fail often. Don't be scared of it. The sooner you fail, the more aware you become of how to fail and how you can kind of divert when it comes around next time. I think there's such a hang up about perfection at the moment in every aspect. We have so much advice from people and I think everybody likes to take loads of advice and then get paralyzed. Like we said earlier, the 80-20 rule, get in. If it's content you're after, create the content. It will be perfect down the line, but I'm failing daily. Still. So I think we need to learn to fail more.
Me and Ben were talking about tattoos yesterday. And we're talking about, I think one of my next ones is going to be deeds, not words. Just deeds matter 100x more than words. Jeff, that was a phenomenal interview. Thank you for being being honest about your whole journey. It's sensational. Where can people get hooked up with some New Dimensions gear?
I mean, newdimensionsactive.ie, that's us. I'm everywhere. Grafton Street online is where we're predominantly. So www.newdimensionsactive.ie.
Jeff, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Gary. Cheers, bud.
Hope you enjoyed my chat with Jeff. Wherever you're listening, whether it's on Spotify, Apple or YouTube, hit that subscribe button. It really helps the pod to grow. I'll see you back here in a couple of days.